Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The State of the Union address is more than a speech. It is theater, sometimes at its best and sometimes at its worst. If you watch them, you will know what I'm talking about. The main character, of course, is the president. And the supporting roles fill the rest of the room, kind of like a chorus in a Greek tragedy, I guess. Somewhere between them rest two monitors that feed the words to the president. And sometimes you have to read or listen between the lines to get the whole story. So we invited a political scientist and an historian to help us do that today. David Stebbin is an associate professor of history in OSU's history department, co-chair of the Modern U.S. History Seminar at Ohio State, and chair of the Ohio Legal History Seminar. Thanks for being with us today, David.
A pleasure, Ann.
And also with us in the studio, Paul Beck, former dean of the OSU College of Social and Behavioral Sciences, where he is now a distinguished professor and also professor of political science, communication, and sociology. You kind of cover the waterfront, so thanks, Paul, for being with us.
Good to be with you, Ann, and welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I thought we would kind of start at the end and open with a clip from the speech that occurred at the very end of the speech. Okay.
We have finished a difficult year. We have come through a difficult decade. But a new year has come. A new decade stretches before us. We don't quit. I don't quit. Let's seize this moment to start anew, to carry the dream forward, and to strengthen our union once more.
Wow, a lot of kind of images in that the last paragraph, really what I thought of as the last paragraph of the speech that was substantive, I guess. Did it sum up what he was trying to get at last night? What do you think it did for him last night?
Well, I think there are two things here. One, of course, is that he's been president for a year, and it's been a difficult year. He inherited difficulties and troubles. We seem to be working our way out of the economic problems. On the other hand, what has opened up really the last 6 months, probably since the summer, is a reversal in momentum. The Democrats had momentum going into 2009. It carried with them for a while. They have lost that momentum now, particularly with the Massachusetts results and the New Jersey and Virginia gubernatorial contest back in November. And so the Democrats face a political problem. And the political problem is with the 2010 elections coming up, their popularity in the country has declined. It's kind of interesting, by the way, that so has the popularity of the Republicans. And this is this partisan polarization issue that the president alluded to, with a lot of Americans saying we really don't like either one of them. We don't have much confidence in either one of them. He did raise during the speech this whole question of trust in government and trust in the political authorities to be able to make the right decisions to get us out of these difficult times. And so in some ways, you know, by saying he's not quitting, he's recognizing that the momentum is against his party and to some degree against himself, although to a lesser degree, but that there are still challenges there and he's going to try to rise to meet those challenges.
And David, when he was saying these things, particularly that last paragraph, he kind of like was doing a laser beam stare at the Republicans.
Right. And I agree with everything that Paul just said. What I would add is I think the subtext was in particular about health care, because leading Republicans in Congress leading up to this speech had said he really ought to drop health care for a while and focus on other things. But he mentioned health care last night. He's going to push ahead with it. He exhorted them to do the same, reminded the Republicans that one consequence of the Massachusetts result is that they now have responsibility again if they just use their 41 votes in the Senate to block legislation. That could ultimately work very poorly for them. And so it was I think it was not surprising to me. I didn't think the president and his people would listen to the Republicans and give up on health care. It doesn't really make much political sense or other sense for the Congress to do that. It was an interesting tone, though, because it didn't have the off-putting kind of quality or tone that I associate with sort of President Nixon, for example. I'm not a quitter.
Under attack, that kind of.
Or self-pitying or anything. None of that. It's just a sort of firmness, determination.
Well, exactly. I mean, when he was talking about the jobs bill, he urged the Senate. It's House passed jobs bill. He urged the Senate to do the same. And it was one of his stronger moments in terms of forcefulness, saying, and I know they will, and I want a jobs bill on my desk without delay. And, you know, it was kind of – he did everything but pound the table in front of him, and I thought that was kind of interesting.
It is. And it helps that all of the members of the House are up for reelection in the fall and a third of the Senate. And the economy is terrible. So it's a sort of intimidating time to be an incumbent in either party. And there, as Paul mentioned, the Democrats are feeling this. Their numbers are down. Republican numbers are down. Congress is less popular than the president. And so they have to produce or voters will punish them in the fall. And they know that. The good news for them, and especially for the president, is that the downward trajectory of the economy has basically stopped. The question is, do we get much of an upward, especially in employment, between now and October? And if we don't, then I don't know what's going to happen in those off-year races.
I think David's right. Employment is the major challenge here. The stock market, though not this past week, but generally has been moving up, regaining a lot of lost ground. But the unemployment picture is not a good picture. And, of course, unemployment in a recession always comes late. It's very sluggish here. And, of course, there is some concern that the basic nature of the American economy has undergone a change, mm-hmm. and that we may never achieve the kind of employment levels, particularly the quality employment levels, that we've had in the past. I'm not that pessimistic. I don't think the president is either. I don't think the Republicans are. But, of course, we will see over time.
He suggested that we have to take risks. We have to stick our necks out. We've got to do something extreme to compete with China, to compete with India and that sort of thing. They want to be first. They want to be in first place. I will never settle for anything but, you know, America becoming first. So he did invoke sort of that traditional, we're number one.
Yes.
Right. And not everyone responds positively to this that sort
right.
of nationalistic rhetoric. But I do think it motivates, the sense that we're falling behind other countries in the way we deal with economic problems motivates people to change the school system, other things. The interesting dynamic at work was, of course, that the deficit was big when the president came in. He's made it bigger, he and his team, by passing an economic stimulus package. If they spend a lot on construction, public works projects, things like that to drive up employment and restore the economy, in the short run, the deficit will probably get bigger. And yet the president seems to be saying in the short run, we don't have any choice but to keep doing this. But there's a lot of pushback, pressure from the Republicans especially, that you can create other kinds of serious problems if the deficit becomes unmanageable.
He mentioned, too, that this will all end. He wants to put the spending freezes in 2011.
That's right. And there was a certain the body language of the Republicans at that moment was skeptical, to say the least. In other words, this puts it after the next election cycle. And so if you've been around a while and you're skeptical, don't have much confidence in political people, you might think, well, this is just moving things back to a point and then they'll move it back some more. But as a matter of economics, the president makes a certain amount of sense. In other words, the unemployment rate is too high for most people. People are not buying things. The economy is sluggish. If you employ more people, you will drive the economy upward. And there's not much inflation. So in the short run, concerns about the deficit leading to inflation don't seem all that serious. It's more the if you lock in the federal government budget into this big growing debt, then you have a very serious long-term problem. And it'll be interesting to see what they do. They're going to try to cut some things and expand spending in other areas in a bipartisan way. That's a tall order.
Such as it is.
It
was
right.
interesting with the proposed 2011 freeze. You know, the Republicans were skeptical. But on the other side, the real hardcore Democrats were like, no way. You know, they don't believe in that. That's anathema. You know, they believe spending is what's going to stimulate the economy and that sort of thing. So he's sort of damned if he doesn't, damned if he does on that score. It was interesting to see the same sort of stoniness on either side of the aisle.
That's
there.
Right.
Well, I would add, I think the real challenge here is to get the balance right. And the balance is short-term stimulation, doing it in a way that contributes to longer-term growth. And so you want to build infrastructure. You want to invest in things that will last over time to the extent that you can. But of course, if you do too much stimulation, that then creates problems down the road in terms of budget deficits. If you don't do enough, we are still in recession. And, of course, the thing that will add the most to the federal budget on the revenue side is increases in employment, is more prosperity. We could close that budget gap, a lot of it, pretty quickly if we were to return to close to a full employment economy. And I don't think that's going to happen in the short run. But that's the trickiness of this. And does he have it right? Well, it's hard to know. We may know 5 years from now, but we may not know right now. And he's engaged in what I like to call the politics of governing, trying to get things done, pass programs, deal with the challenges that are there. There's an inevitable tendency for the opposition party to engage in the politics of campaigning and not to take responsibility. And, of course, what he was doing in the speech over and over again is saying, look, you folks are responsible too, and you need to step up to that.
He also wanted to set the record straight, and he did that about 40 minutes into the speech when he talked about the deficit and what he walked into when he took office a little over a year ago. Let's listen to that.
So let me start the discussion of government spending by setting the record straight. At the beginning of the last decade, the year 2000, America had a budget surplus of over $200 billion. By the time I took office, we had a one-year deficit of over $1 trillion and projected deficits of $8 trillion over the next decade. Most of this was the result of not paying for two wars, two tax cuts, and an expensive prescription drug program.
Okay, and of course he slapped a few more trillion on top of that, and that's what Republicans go after. How effective is it, do you think, to make those sorts of clarifications?
Well,
David?
If you're trying to establish a tone of let's be fair, fair-minded about this discussion, that's a good place to start. And I'm very glad that he didn't just mention the tax cuts that President Bush Jr. pushed through, because there is spending on the military, there is the prescription drug program. So there are other initiatives that have created this current situation. And so I thought that was fine. The only part of it that bothered me at all that I thought was slightly misleading was, when I came in the door, in the sense it made it sound as though he had traveled from Illinois, where he had been utterly uninvolved with the federal government until he became president, when, of course, he had been in the Senate. So he'd been part of the process.
Well, he was in the back room, too.
That's right.
At a certain point.
That's right. And so he's not quite as detached from what went on before he became president as that might suggest. But he was not a major determiner of what was going on for most of that period.
And it's worth adding that what he didn't do is single out Bush by name.
That's right.
As the culprit here. And in the past, he has. And so you see him backing away a bit from that. I mean, I do think he needed to make the case that he did inherit some of this. And, of course, there are things that were done over the past year that were done by the Obama administration that contributed certainly to the deficit. But getting the numbers right in thinking about all of this is very important. His contribution to the deficit was $1 trillion. The deficit's much larger than that, considerably larger than that by several times. And so that's only part of it. The big culprit there, of course, is the recession, denying the revenues and increasing the amount of money government has to spend on social support programs.
Okay, we have to take a quick break. If you would like to join the conversation with David Stebbin and Paul Beck, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
I'm Tom Ashbrook, host of NPR's On Point. When the going gets tough, it can be too easy to forget the things large and small that give life its richness, its joy. Whether it's kids or cooking, music, movies, ball games, a symphony, a good book. Here at On Point, we won't forget the sunny side of the street. Come join us for the next On Point.
And On Point begins this afternoon at 1 o'clock, right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. 22 degrees in downtown Columbus, steady temperatures in the low 20s this afternoon, and then a few clouds tonight and a chilly night with a low of 7 degrees. Looking ahead to Friday, partly sunny and a high of 23, and partly sunny on Saturday with a high of 24. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the State of the Union address last night. What did you think? Give us a call. 614-292-8513. My guest, David Stebbin, a professor of history at OSU, and also Paul Beck, former dean of the OSU College of Social and Behavioral Sciences. He's now a distinguished professor there. He's also a professor of political science, communication, and sociology, and all kinds of stuff, which is why we have these guys in here, because they know all sorts of things, very multidimensional. I noticed this time that he did not use the audience members as props, that the president didn't point people out in the audience. Now, we kind of know they were there, as usual. There are a lot more people than just lawmakers and officialdom. What is the pros and cons of doing that sort of thing? And we know, we mentioned earlier, it was not by accident. Everything is very well thought out.
Everything is scripted.
Paul?
Right. Well, I've always thought it's kind of hokey to do that, to tell you the truth. Now, maybe it adds a local color to the event and it allows people who are watching it to kind of relax for a minute and not pay so much attention to the speech itself. But I did notice that last night. Those people were there.
Mm-hmm.
He had invited guests. They were sitting around his wife in the gallery there. But for the first time since I've been watching State of the Union addresses, the guests were not introduced.
That was the first. Okay, I wasn't sure if I'd missed something, but I thought it was very unusual.
Well, and the history of that practice is that it began with Ronald Reagan. And when it began with Reagan, it was a fresh, new thing to do. And like so many innovations in the world of politics and drama, it's partly theater, after a while it began to seem somewhat stale. So I think part of it's that. But also I think President Obama is more like an academic than the typical American politician when he speaks. And he has a lot of points that he wants to cover. And I just don't think he had much room last night. It was a long speech, right. The longest since 2000. About
and whenever somebody
minutes,
stands up like that, it invokes applause and
right.
all that.
It slows things down. So I think those two reasons probably are decisive. And he might bring it back. I think if you have someone who does something utterly remarkable that or achieves national attention, something like that, then having that person introduced, that practice might continue. But, it's a work in progress. You try to develop new ways of engaging the public. He's a very good public speaker, the president. I was struck by that anew when I listened to him last night. He's really very good, regardless of partisanship, in delivery.
Do you think he recaptured the magic of his campaign oratory? I think I saw that headline or that question in the New York Times this morning.
I think it would be hard to do that. There was a lot of magic in the campaign. Part of it, the novelty of the candidate himself, but it's hard to do that when you're in governing, because governing involves making choices. When you make choices, people are going to react, some of them negatively, to those choices. And of course, I think the public, in its wisdom, and it is a wisdom, is very much results oriented. They don't really know the intricacies of these policies. They can't really debate the pros and cons. What they want is something that works and works to solve the problems as they see them. And that's certainly true with the economy. So if the stimulus package works, it'll be a plus with the public. If it appears not to be working, people are going to be a little skeptical about it. And that may be where we are right now, quite frankly.
He did invoke two names, the folks who are the sponsors of the fiscal review commission, the legislation that would look at the fiscal policies, and it didn't pass in the House. He mentioned
yes.
that, and that's when he said he was going to create one by executive order. But he did. I think those are the only other names besides Michelle Obama and Joe Biden. Am I wrong?
And he didn't have
them stand up either. So
yes.
they didn't get
well,
a lot of
And I
time.
Think what he may be doing there, it'd be preferable if through legislation Congress were to set up such a commission. And he may be putting pressure on Congress by saying, well, okay, if you don't do this, I'm going to do it by executive order. Majorities in Congress favor it. And we're again left with this odd situation in the Senate where majorities are not enough. You have to be able to overcome the filibuster, and everything gets filibustered.
Although the Senate situation is interesting in that the last time Paul and I were on, which was about a year ago, this was the situation in the Senate.
Yeah.
In other words, the Democrats did not have quite 60, mm-hmm. and there was a need for at least some moderate Republican support for major initiatives. So what is it we jokingly said the last time we were on? The Maine women, the two senators from
yes.
Maine, Susan Collins and Olympia Snowe, would ultimately determine whatever would pass in the U.S. Senate. And then there was this interval in between when, because Norm Coleman, the moderate Republican senator from Minnesota, was ultimately defeated after a long process of recounting and so on by the Democrat Al Franken, the Democrats achieved briefly the magic 60, changing the whole dynamic of how to go about this. And all of a sudden the initiatives, well, we have 60 Democrats in the Senate. We don't have to bargain with Republicans. And you know, a majority or having just barely enough, generally you don't want to rely upon that. It's an uncertain world. And of course, the fates have not smiled. And so we're back to where we were before. And so in retrospect, a certain amount of valuable time has been wasted by the White House. If they had continued to work with Senator Snowe in particular, it would have been slower in some ways, but ultimately more productive. And now they have to back up and try again with her, I suspect. And also with the new senator from Massachusetts, who is from a very blue state. He, as a state senator, voted for the health insurance plan that then
right.
Governor Romney created and passed the legislature. And he's a firm believer in insuring people. The Massachusetts perspective on the health care issue is fascinating to me because they have insured almost everyone, 98%. What they don't want to pay is double, something paying for themselves at the state level and then paying even more in some sense for themselves because of a new federal program, which is a very legitimate concern, and I would have it were I a voter in Massachusetts. But it's not the typical kind of objection to the president's plan that you get from people in other states, right? And so there are some people out there to work with, but it's really a different idea. The unhappiest man in Washington after the Brown victory was, I think, Senator Nelson, the conservative Democrat from Nebraska, because you don't have to work so much with someone like that now as with Senator Snowe. So it's a bit of a detour, but the dynamic has changed and then changed again.
In fact, what's ironic about it is that you move from Olympia Snowe being sort of the swing person to Joe Lieberman being the swing person, and Joe Lieberman was empowered during
That's
that
right.
period. And then
sure.
Ben Nelson becomes empowered, and in some ways, you know, the Senate Democrats may be better off that they don't have this filibuster-proof majority, or at least seemingly so. And that may get them back to the table to do some negotiating with Republicans.
Well, that brought up one of the times that he admonished Democrats involved this vote count. You know, even with 60, the Democrats are not a monolithic force.
That's right.
Under the best of circumstances, that's their nature.
Right.
Senator Lieberman is probably case in point. You know,
yes.
Top of the pile. We have a clip from that, how he talks about the vote count and what that brings, what kind of responsibility that brings with it. Let's listen to that now.
Our administration has had some political setbacks this year, and some of them were deserved. But I wake up every day knowing that they are nothing compared to the setbacks that families all across this country have faced this year.
Okay, that wasn't the clip I was looking for, but that's okay. We can talk about that anyways. He mentioned that he talked to the Democrats about, you know, you can't run for the hills now. You've got to do what is right. And as far as that brought on protracted applause. And then at the same time mentioned to the Republicans and also, you know, the vote you have now. You now have responsibility to take part in this and to lead.
That's right. But the president is attempting to construct a kind of centrist majority for most of his major legislative proposals. But both parties have strong wings that are either more strongly conservative if you're the Republicans or strongly liberal if you're the Democrats. And so how you fashion this sort of middle, moderate majority, the independent block of voters in the country, that's what they want. They have very little patience with Democrats and Republicans not being able to work together. And the president has some of that. You sort of saw it last night. He wants teamwork. He wants cooperation, especially now that we're back to a situation where the Republicans share formal responsibility. In a way, it's just too bad that we've had this detour. The illusion that 60 votes in the Senate for the Democrats meant that they could essentially ignore all Republican objections. But it's just the life, and he has to live with the consequences of this, and so does everyone else. And there's still time. And by the way, while it affects health care, it affects everything else.
Yes.
Every other major
bill. Everything, every ball is up in the air
right now.
Yeah. Let's listen to another one because he talks about that conflict, and the I'm not naive remark was sort of interesting and a little snarky, but let's listen to that now.
Now, I'm not naive. I never thought that the mere fact of my election would usher in peace and harmony and some post-partisan era. I knew that both parties have fed divisions that are deeply entrenched. And on some issues, there are simply philosophical differences that will always cause us to part ways. These disagreements about the role of government in our lives, about our national priorities and our national security, they've been taking place for over 200 years. They're the very essence of our democracy. But what frustrates the American people is a Washington where every day is election day.
Okay. Let's take some calls right now. 614-292-8513. And a caller from Worthington, you're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
This is the moment of Emperor Has No Clothes. Obama came in with such an overwhelming mandate to do change our direction drastically, foreign policy, domestically, and he did not show decisive leadership in both areas, and that's why we have Virginia, New Jersey, Massachusetts debacle. I don't understand smart men like President Obama did not get the message clearly from these results. And then he's talking as though the world is the same as before.
You think?
Yeah. It's amazing that he did not get the message.
You know, actually, though, a couple times, and I wanted David and Paul to talk about this, he admitted they've made mistakes, and that's unusual. That was a big criticism of the previous administration. David, Paul, what did you think about that?
Well, I think this was Karl Rove's strategy for many years, both when George Bush was governor of Texas and then later in the White House, and that is you never admit a mistake, at least never publicly. I think it's probably not a particularly good strategy. And the president yesterday, indeed, and in fact, there was a debate.
Reversed it.
Well, there was a debate within his staff over just exactly how he should say that. And he ended up saying that in a more humbling way than I think some of them were recommending, in fact. But I actually want to come back to the point that she was making, the caller was making. I think there's a danger in misinterpreting the results of the 2008 election. As I read those results, it was very much a negative result or a negative view of the Bush administration. Voting against something. Sure, there were people who supported Obama because of the dream, because of the kinds of things that he represented, but it wasn't close to a majority. It wasn't close to giving him a mandate for change except to be not Bush. And I think there's a danger in overinterpreting the results in Virginia, New Jersey, and of course now Massachusetts. And that is to read them as somehow a big victory for Republicanism and conservatism. I think they also were a reaction to the status quo or the situation at the time. And I think a lot of voters are saying, as they were in 2008 and now again in 2010, we don't like what you folks are doing in Washington, and it's all of you. It's not just Democrats. It's not just Republicans. And, of course, we live in this area of very sharp partisan polarization that some of the country buys into. The more partisan people, but there's a large group in the middle who sees this as unnecessary noise and unnecessary division. And I think the president tried to capture that last night rhetorically. Whether we can capture it in terms of the politics of governing and policies is quite another matter, because he has to persuade the Congress, of course, to go along with him.
If the reactionary tendencies of the electorate were a ping pong game, we'd have whiplash trying to watch it. It just goes back and forth and back and forth now. Well, I mean, I can't get my lawn mowed in a year. I mean, the things that people expect to have done in a year. And that's not to say that he was right or wrong or that he can't achieve it ever, but a year?
Well, and it's been a very tough year economically, which has an effect on incumbents of both parties and all philosophies. We've had three major elections in this past year, and it's very dangerous to draw sweeping conclusions from any of them. In the New Jersey gubernatorial race, the Democratic incumbent was very unpopular and got voted out of office. He didn't do what he said he would do explicitly when he ran the last time. So that's a reason to get fired from your job, especially if voters are in a bad mood, as they are around the country. The new governor of Virginia, the winner who spoke last night, he was the person who gave the Republican response, and we could talk about that if you want, because it's kind of interesting in a few respects, Bob McDonnell. The Democratic turnout in Virginia dropped. The Republican turnout did not rise. In other words, he was very humble, Bob McDonnell, when he won in Virginia in the fall of 09, because he understood that. In other words, it was more the weaknesses of his Democratic opponent than any seismic shift in the electorate that carried him to victory. And he's considered a rising star because he's actually a likable person, projects well. And I watch these responses as much as I can. And I watched the whole response last night. And the most interesting thing to me about it was simply the staging of it. In other words,
the response.
That's right. Mm-hmm. If you remember Bobby Jindal, the Republican rising star from Louisiana, he looked isolated and almost adolescent in the setting, the way he delivered that. And it really has hurt his chances to become a future star in the party. So what did they do? They have a very beautiful state capitol in the Commonwealth of Virginia that's very old and historic. And so they put people in the audiences in this chamber. So it looked like a replica of what President Obama did, speaking to a joint session. So there are people behind him, a demographically mixed group of ordinary Virginians. There are people applauding. So it simulated what a President McDonnell talking to the national legislative body, what that might be like. And that's an interesting new idea. I thought it was better. It just made for energy in the room and visually and so on. In terms of the substance, though, there wasn't a great deal of anything that was new. He himself is a brand new governor. He's been in office for a very short time. He wasn't trying to lay out a national agenda for his party.
But he was representing the entire party. And
that's right.
Some folks that I was reading on Facebook this morning and looking at different chat on threads were frustrated that the Republicans didn't come back with more of a point-on-point response, and that they can. I mean, gosh, I mean, with the technology the way it is now, you could have someone taking notes. You know, you could have 50 people sitting there taking notes while he's doing and coming up with.
Right, and he did not try to do that to rebut the president's speech. The fact that they picked someone brand new is a statement of how difficult it is for the Republicans now to find broadly appealing leaders. They just don't have very many.
That was the idea with Bobby Jindal last year.
Right. And he flamed out. But he wasn't as new as this. In other words, this man has been in office since the first
2 weeks of January.
That's right. So not a long time. And so it wouldn't be appropriate for him to try to match the president. The other problem is the Republicans don't have a program that broadly unites the party and that appeals to swing voters. And so how you – they're a work in progress. Even they say so, because they have a strongly conservative wing and a more moderate wing, and the two are very much in conflict. And they'll work it out, but it's going to take them a while.
We have to take another break. I'm sorry. Sure. We'll come right back to this. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Join WOSU Public Media today by becoming a volunteer. WOSU's Winter Pledge Drive is coming up, and we need your help. Answer calls from WOSU listeners like you this February. From February 4th to February 12th, there are many opportunities for you to help out. For more information, including dates and times, call 292-9678 or visit wosu.org/volunteer.
And good morning. You're listening to WOSU 820 NPR News. And stay right here with All Sides with Ann Fisher. At 11 o'clock, we'll hear about using Ohio native plants in residential landscaping with Franklin Soil and Water Conservation District and the Columbus Dispatch Home and Garden Editor. That discussion begins at 11 right here on WOSU 820. Cloudy skies today with some sunshine this afternoon and a few snow flurries, and a cold afternoon. Temperatures dropping throughout the afternoon, currently 22 degrees at 10:41. Even colder tonight, a few clouds and a low of 7 degrees tonight. Partly sunny for Friday and a high of 23.
Support for WOSU comes from The Other Paper, Columbus's news and entertainment weekly, on newsstands every Thursday and online at theotherpaper.com. This is WOSU, NPR News and Classical Music.
All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on WOSU 820, NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the State of the Union address last night. Did you watch it, and did you care? We're talking about it today with David Stebbin, an OSU history professor, and also Paul Beck. He's an OSU political scientist. We had the caller from Worthington said that it was the emperor with no clothes night. Mac, you're on the air. You say you disagree with that.
Yes. You know, thank you for calling my call. Taking my call.
My pleasure.
You know, Mr. Obama has been just only a president only for 1 year, and he has been stopping the bleeding of the economy, and we are in the moment of going upwards, you know, economically and politically. Now America is received by the whole world of, you know, as the leader of the the great nation, mm-hmm. Seen by, you know, morally acceptable and everything. So people are expecting of him a lot from him, while the problem has been passed through his plate is a lot of problems. So I just want to voice that one.
Thanks a lot. You know, that reminds you when you mention how he's seen around the world. This is not just an address to the American people. It's an address to the entire world, right? It's much broader than that. Thank you, Mac. At the end, he kind of whipped in a whole bunch of issues there at the end. I mean, you know, we can go through the issues. There were no surprises in the larger sense, you know, healthcare, jobs, all of that stuff that we expected, national security, although he didn't give a lot of time to that, not as much as I thought he might. But it's really not on top of everybody's list right now either, interestingly. Funny how things can change. But at the end, he kind of talked about reactivating, you know, the civil rights efforts and getting going on that more. Equal pay for women, promised immigration reform, and the repeal of the ban on gays in the military, or the don't ask, don't tell philosophy or policy. And Michael Daniels, you're on the air. You wanted to talk about that, publisher of Outlook.
I am. Good morning, Ann.
How you doing?
Good. Yeah, I actually was very impressed that he brought that up last night in a time when it's all about jobs and the economy and jobs in the economy, putting that in at the end. I actually thought he would loop that in to the section on national security, because this is really one of those issues that, A, it's just the right thing to do and it's the right time to do it, but two, it's a national security issue. Since 1994, the United States military, all branches, have discharged over 13,500 service members based purely on their sexual orientation. And when you're in the middle of what we're in the middle of with fighting wars and fighting terrorism, it doesn't make sense to discharge really talented people based on some arcane concept that we know is completely bogus, and we have militaries around the world who have who've gotten rid of these kinds of bans, and they function just fine. So it was interesting to me to see that he looped that in as a civil rights piece. I really thought it might come in as part of the overall, if we're going to fight the war in Afghanistan and fight the war on terror in a smart way, we should start using these people's talents rather than spending time and resources on kicking them out.
David and Paul, were you surprised that he kind of brought in all those issues at the very end the way he did?
Well, we had a lot of leaks during the week about things that he was going to do. They were not the main thrust of his speech, but obviously he wanted to touch on them.
And there's a certain emphasis when you bring them up at the end, too.
Yes. I think in terms of the ban on gays in the military or the don't ask, don't tell policy, this is something he had promised to do in the campaign. And so what he really is doing here is appealing to a part of his base by saying, well, okay, I'm going to follow through on this right now. I think it's not going to be particularly controversial in the military.
I think
they're ready
that's
for
true,
this.
David. I think that's absolutely true. If you look at the statistics that we've seen, about 73% of current military personnel, that was a Zogby poll in 2006, so the number's got to be higher than that now, say they just don't care.
Right.
It's just, you know, do your job, and they just don't care. And I think you're right. He has to appeal to the base because they're particularly among gays and lesbians nationwide. There's a certain sense of disillusionment of some things that the gay community feels like ought to be pretty simple to get done, particularly with majorities in both houses of Congress, that haven't moved along. And this is something that I think that the president can move pretty quickly and does play to the base. And it is fulfilling a campaign promise in an election year. It makes a lot of sense.
Thanks for the call, Michael.
Thanks, Ann.
Take care. You know, when he brought that issue up, you get the stony-faced military type sitting there, almost as stony-faced as the U.S. Supreme Court was when he did something what I thought was very unusual and admonished them for the ruling on corporate campaign contributions last week.
Right. Their presence at this, and I've attended one joint session and sat in the chair, they're the odd people, the military and the Supreme Court, because they're not part of the elected branches of the government. They're sort of not supposed to be involved in partisan disputes. They go because it's customary and so on, but they always look slightly uncomfortable. And
yes.
Justice Alito, who was the key swing vote on the campaign finance decision, you literally could see his lips move. That's not true. He'd had his own much more quiet version of the Joe Wilson moment. And of course, TV camera work being what it is, they zoomed in on that. And so and they replayed it afterwards. So here's Justice Alito reacting to that passage. The military people are trained to be stolid, expressionless.
Wow.
And they lived up to that.
And these are generals.
The Joint Chiefs, that's right. And an admiral, right, lived up to that.
Well trained.
And it is a complex issue for the military because even if a large majority don't care, a smaller minority is intensely opposed, and that's a difficult thing to administer. The good news for the military is when they make a decision, desegregation, for example, of the armed forces, they have a command and control system that is stronger than civilian society. They can issue commands. They must be obeyed. But there was no sense of enthusiasm for this from the leadership of the Joint Chiefs last night, at least visually. Who knows how they feel?
I kept looking for a glint in one of their eyes or a little shadow of a smile or something. But on the other hand, you don't hear that they're necessarily the ones that are opposed to gays in the military. I think that they get the point and agree with the point that Michael was making, that this makes our military stronger, not weaker.
Well, and I think even if some do agree, and some surely do at the leadership level, they're resigned to this. And it's not a big issue anymore for them. Other issues are much more pressing right now. And of course, one of the things, and the caller pointed this out, is that we learn from reading about people who have been dismissed from the military that they are losing expertise in certain key areas, language skills, for example, which they don't have an abundance of anyway.
At least
in
not
terms
the right
of Arabic
language,
speakers
right.
and others. And so I think it's a matter of balancing, and probably the military leadership feels that there are other things we care more about than we care about this.
Okay, let's take a caller from Gary. You've been waiting for a long time. You're on the air on WOSU. Hi, Gary.
Yeah. Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. You wanted to talk about George Bush, even though he never said his name once last night.
And that's the thing that, it's typical politics. I inherited this from so-and-so, and I inherited that from so-and-so. But what he didn't mention was, I mean, we have a bad economy right now, but if President Bush hadn't gone and cleaned up Iraq and run Saddam Hussein and his group of thugs out of Kuwait and protected Saudi Arabia, Can you imagine our economy right now in the condition it's in?
You mean you're talking about the other Bush, or you're talking
either one of them? Both of them has something to do with Iraq.
Yeah, but
the issue is, can you imagine our economy right now, the way it is, as bad as it is? On top of that, add $4 and $5 a gallon gasoline if the crude flow had been interrupted. So what I'm saying is, it's expensive to fight a war.
Okay.
And it's even worse to fight an insurgency war like we're fighting in Afghanistan.
Okay.
So as far as I'm concerned, is there's multiple compound situations that are really never clearly defined, and frankly, you folks haven't discussed it either.
Well, the one thing I would add about the war that was really newsworthy and interesting last night was the president's very explicit statement that all U.S. combat troops are going to be withdrawn from Iraq by the, midsummer?
August
of this year.
And that is fulfilling probably the most important commitment he made to the liberal wing of the Democratic Party when he ran for president. His anti-war stance, more than anything else, helped him become the nominee in the face of a very difficult fight with Hillary Clinton. And again, the images of the military people shown on TV at the Joint Chiefs, again, stone-faced.
Right.
On that issue, I think they're probably much more sort of ambivalent or conflicted, withdrawing all of them, right? And so where we go from here, so to speak, whether or not that works out in the way the president hopes it works out, in other words, the Iraqi situation remains stable, the nation returns to something like normal political life and social life, who can say? But it was, to me, the riskiest thing he announced that he was going to do last night. But in some sense, he has to keep some of his promises to the liberal wing of the Democratic Party, and that's probably the most important one he made when he ran.
Or at least remind them that he remembers that he made the promise.
That's right.
Yeah, I think David's absolutely right on that. I would add to that that he was very careful in how he worded that statement, and it was that they would not be in combat roles.
That's right.
After August of 2010. Now, you know, what does that mean? I'm not entirely sure what it means. It's a definitional issue to some degree. I think we can all hope that that will be the situation there. But, of course, we don't control Iraq completely, and it'll be interesting to see what transpires over time. Coming back to Bush for just a minute, I think it's important to differentiate between the two Iraq wars.
Right.
And I think all of us know that. The other thing that I think that I personally would fault the president, President Bush, for with the second war is that he wasn't willing to finance it through the budget process. It was financed off budget, in effect. It contributed to the deficit. What he should have asked us to do as citizens in the country is pay for the war at the time rather than push that debt forward.
Well, he was able to do that, though, because at the time he was saying that we were in imminent danger,
yes,
that there were weapons of mass destruction. That's why we went in the first place. And with those kinds of fears instilled, that's how Congress reacted.
Well, and also it's a complicated situation because the economy at the time was not all that strong because it did decline sharply in 2001. So if you have too much pain in terms of taxation, you could actually make the economic situation worse. And historically, we haven't paid for wars, at least no war in the past 150 or 160 years, fully through taxation. In other words, there's a certain amount of borrowing and there's a certain amount of taxing. But Paul's point is well taken. There were big tax decreases. I was trying to remember the last time that happened, that were announced in 01 and continued as the country went into war, and no major tax increases to pay for it or help pay for it. So that's unusual. It means the deficit grew much larger than it would have otherwise, and that creates other kinds of concerns down the road. And I would say I thought the president was right last night to point out that we need to avoid stereotyping on the issues of the deficit. In other words, in the 30s and the 40s and the 50s, the Democrats were the party of deficits and the Republicans were the party of greater fiscal responsibility. But since Ronald Reagan, those roles have been reversed. The larger deficits in the federal government spending tend to be under Republican presidents than under Democratic. And so the current deficit problem is not entirely the creation of Democrats or Republicans, and solving it obviously is going to require a certain amount of compromise. But the decision to finance the second Iraq war essentially through deficits has been very controversial, even within the Republican Party. Herb Asher was on the show once last year with me, and he emphasized the lack of a call for ordinary Americans to sacrifice mm-hmm. when President Bush Jr. took the country to war. And sacrifice has more than the financial implication, but it's partly that. I always think of these bomb drives they used to have. Say
the Victory Gardens?
That yes. sort of – none of that. Right. And so the much of the country hasn't been asked to do very much during a wartime or semi-wartime situation, and that bothers a lot of people.
Well, there's no draft. There's correct. There's nothing yes. like that. It's
doesn't touch a broad swath of the households, and so that's right. And so it's I can't think of a time quite like it in the modern history of the country.
Let's take another call, Frank. Frank, we only have about a minute and a half left, so if you could take about 30 seconds of it. You wanted to talk about the pace of the speech. You liked
yeah,
it.
I'll just run through this real quick.
Okay.
Ann, you're a natural. Congratulations.
Thank
gentlemen,
you.
Great observations. When I go to the movies, I like great pacing so I can absorb the content. And Obama is a master of the content. The highlights were the Supreme Court decision. I'm sick of the 5-4 decisions. I think the lobbying for the bankers, knowing that this housing bubble was there, can go all the way back to the bankruptcy decision on 5-4. Thank you.
Thanks, Frank. You know, we have an email, and I hesitate to read it because I'm not quite sure I understand it, but I'm going to take a risk because okay. maybe you will. The listener says, it's ironic that the same progressives who used to complain about Bush's unitary presidency are now complaining that Obama hasn't acted the same kind of unitary way. Any comments? So for me, the key word here is unitary. And do you know what?
Well, Vice President Cheney articulated this theory, and Paul's a political scientist. Okay. He'll know more about this than I do, that suggested that the power of the president was somewhat greater than people had earlier believed. And I think for President Obama, the criticism lately has been he's been acting as – trying to move legislation only through his own party.
Okay.
And that's a somewhat
okay.
different point.
Okay. Okay. We're just about out of time. Any parting thoughts? We'll never get to all of it. We have about 15 seconds.
Well, I think one of the messages of the speech last night was that partisan polarization is a problem. It'll be very interesting to see how the president moves forward to try to deal with that problem. And so that's something to look for over the next few months.
And that's all we have time for. Thanks for joining me, Paul Beck and David Stebbin. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.